Welcome to the Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views, as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
The management themselves said, but what are we going to do with this? Look at all the revenue streams we've created, right? Yeah. From this one technology of regular film, we've created inside all the Myers, a place where you go to get it developed. We created the paper film that it gets developed on. Like, we've basically created the way people now buy, you know, disposable cameras and everything else. And it's huge business. Why would we get rid of that? And it's one of those questions that comes with, well, what would we do with all this data? I don't know, until we get all the data and start looking through it. Like, until you go out there and look at all the business cases that would come with digital, to them it was, well, this is counterintuitive to our business model. Right. So why don't we just shelf this long enough that when it actually becomes relevant, we actually may not only not own the patent technology anymore, but somebody else is going to do it better. That's literally what they did.
And then you look at Apple, who literally just cannibalized their own iPod business by creating the iPhone and said, we're going to eat into this. We know we're going to eat into this gorgeous cash cow, but we think the other one will be just as big a cash cow. And it was.
Yeah.
Well, I think that also gets into, since we are kind of a book club that just happens to meet online. The innovator's dilemma kind of gets into a lot of that as well. That for companies having to cannibalize some of their own business to address what's coming in the future. It's inevitable, yeah. Right? You're going to eat into your own market share to be viable in the next phase or the next, I don't know, wave, whatever you want to call it.
So this goes right into security practice though, and it could go into tech practice as well, because you look at what you've used, you know, for the last 5-10 years, or even the last 3 years with COVID and working from home and, you know, all the remote workforce, everything that we were doing before that we bought into before maybe isn't the right way forward. But how do you tell the business, like, well, yeah, I realize that we've already invested in X, Y, and Z, but that no longer works the same way now because of where we're moving. And if we're going to move as fast as we are this way, and that's why when Arun asked the one question, that we kind of lightly skipped over, but Gail had asked, you know, does the security have a seat at the table, you know, in business? And I went right back to the race car, right? Like, as fast as you want to move forward, you still have a braking system. And depending on the speed of your vehicle and the size of your vehicle, the brakes can be bigger or smaller, right? But you can't use the same brakes you were using 20 years ago for a vehicle today that goes 200 plus miles an hour.
Right.
And it just doesn't work.
What I find amusing is that more people haven't heard that analogy and still think it, you know, I mean, it totally makes sense, but it also makes so much, maybe it's just because we've said it so much. It makes so much sense. It's one of those, well, how could you not have thought of this?
Right. But I almost think you could look at security from the standpoint of take the driver out of the equation, put him on the pit box, right? Because he's been doing it so long, he or she understands all of the components that go into the car, how to drive a race, what works within the race. And as you kind of pivot and think about that in the context of security, I think a lot of companies fail to realize the depth that you have on a security team. Mm-hmm. That outside in other IT practitioners, you tend to have people that are specialists in those given areas. But at least, you know, from my own viewpoint, what I've seen is security people are super broad and understand so much across the gamut, across technology, that leaning upon them to not only protect the company, but also build the future could be a huge advantage.
Yeah, I've definitely seen that. And for one of the same reasons that that I mentioned about having people work the help desk, having people take their knowledge both on the start and then periodically to bring that knowledge back to those organizations. And then as well as to learn and to learn, see, and feel what it is that actual customers are doing with your products or systems, or how salespeople have to interact with your security systems. All of that becomes really important. And I'll take a quick moment and just say thank you to the SIM Detroit folks for having us on their monthly call as a remote podcast. Live Great Security Debate goes on the road via Zoom. And it was just a lot of fun. And I think it actually sparks today's topic around, can security be a business differentiator? At the end of the discussion, it was raised that potentially security should not be looked at as a business differentiator, as a competitive advantage. I have some pretty in that I said, stay tuned, because I think this is definitely a debate I want to have. And we decided we wanted to do that today. So let's get at it. So I guess I'll start with the fact that, you know, security is one of those things that for a long time, it was back office. It was completely back office. It was sit back there, crank, sit in the dark room, drink lots of Mountain Dew, and do whatever it is you do, and don't cost us too much money. Over the years, as security has become more and more of a public-facing thing, as you're seeing more and more attacks, as you're seeing now just this week, the SEC have put out some new proposed rulemaking that will increase the amount of decrease the amount of time you have to report a breach. 4 days, I believe, is the current proposal that you have to get to make a formal announcement of what it is that's happened, as well as some declarations about your security posture, your board's security awareness and understanding, meaning, do you have somebody that understands security on your board reporting to your board, and more. So now this is part of business. And therefore, people are making buying decisions, whether it should be or shouldn't be. You know, you get an RFP in for a product. Let's say you're selling some widget or some piece of software. You get an RFP in, and there's a ton of questions related to your security posture. So I think whether you like it or not, security is part of what you're selling. The question is, should you lean into it? And I think we're still in a position of time where, you know, security is good for all of us. And we definitely should lean into it. If you have done and made that investment, why wouldn't you use it as a tout? Because, you know, in the same way that safety ratings on cars are out there, you know, you test on crash test ratings and you know, an airbag safety, and you tout that, you know, these are the safest cars. Why wouldn't you do that with data that you're holding on behalf of other people, or the integrity of the information that you are processing for other people? I can't see a reason why you wouldn't go down that road very loudly, in a way that Apple have, in a way that many others have, to try and make sure that the market understands that the value, the additional value that comes by buying your thing.
Right. Yeah, I'm right there with you. I think there's two components of that, right? There's an inflection point where, as you know, as the tide rises, it raises all boats, right? Mm-hmm. Think about it. At some point, if everybody's got it, it's no longer marketable. It's just, it is, right? And I think this the struggle. So the second point of that is to try to quantify what's the value of marketing security. So for instance, you know, if we look at automotive, the push to, if you're an early adopter of either TISAX or TSAX, or if you look at what's coming out with the ISO standards around building security into the product development lifecycle and all of that, it's shadow pricing, right? It's a tough metric to try to quantify what is the actual return on investment for those efforts. If you're recognizing that you have to be there at some point, then it's kind of a sunk cost, right? You're going down that journey anyways. You might as well try to pull it forward and use it in a market differentiator. But I think that becomes the struggle. And that's, you know, for me at least, that ties back to our typical struggle within security and metrics and KPIs anyways, that a lot of what we do is hard to quantify. And I think to become a business differentiator, we're going to have to be better at quantifying the efforts that we're putting into the security program.
I'm going to agree with both you. but I'm also going to say that
it's not a very good debate if we all agree with each other, Brian.
So I agree with you guys, but from the business side, and I'm going to turn to manufacturing, and I know, again, people are going to laugh, but specifically shocked. Automotive, because get ready, right? Get ready, because your business now is really going to have their hands in stuff, asking questions. If you see what's come down the line from General Motors, from Volvo, from Toyota, and just it's not even a questionnaire. It's part of their purchasing policy now. So in the old days, and I shouldn't even call them old days, because then I'll age myself, but just 5 years ago, when you were quoting new business, right, for these OEs as a supplier, you were filling out, it's not even a questionnaire. You go through a very detailed production control quality questionnaire. They come in and they audit your systems through the whole entire sourcing process. Now these same companies are saying that if we have contracts with you for parts that we're buying that are going to be for more than a year and a half left of contract, then you have to now start abiding by these new rules, right? And it's all these cybersecurity controls. And what I'm going to turn to is the fact that when we would answer these things, we would come back with all the yes or no's and the details and sit in front of the business, right? As a salesperson, I'd sit in front of my executives and say, I think this is going to be a problem. Production control said no to this, but here's the reason. I mean, in no short 2 hours did we have the plant manager on the phone trying to explain to us why it is he said no to that. And then he would jump into a detailed, you know, rundown of, but here's how we do it, right? Like, I have to say no to that, but we're really doing it. So then we have to take all that detail back and give it to the customer. The same thing's going to happen on security. And I don't think security teams are going to be ready for it in these tier two, tier three, you know, tier one suppliers, where all of a sudden their business is saying, hey, I need 20 minutes of your time. We need you to jump on a phone call, right? Or a video here in the next 30 minutes. It's like, why? Why is the sales team calling us? Why is the vice president of sales all of a sudden all over us? And there's going to be this little bit of friction at first of why are they questioning what we're doing? But it's not that. They're worried when they turn this thing in that the customer is going to come back and say, I'm sorry, you don't meet the requirements we have, and until you do. So you're trying to get answers. And that's going to be the first step, right? Is understanding that. And then the business is going to start to understand, when I say business, when you're going after new business, these people that are working on those projects are really going to start to understand security more. Just like I learned to understand quality and production control more because of the number of times I was questioned on it, right? Or like when you did a PFEMA, right? And you knew somebody was just reproducing the old one from 4 years ago and re-putting it on the new one, but yet there's new processes and you're calling them out like, hey, we're going to get in trouble. Like all you did was recopy the old one onto the new, right? Like
yeah.
Nothing's changed in 5 years, right? So where I'm going with this is, and the reason I'm stating this out loud is, this isn't just because the automotive companies are demanding it from the OE down. Now you saw, and Eric, you called it out, manufacturing in automotive is going to be considered critical infrastructure. That applies to the OEs. That's why they're going to push these requirements down, because now for them to be shut down, it's not because they got hit, right? Now you have the supply chain issues. You saw it with Bridgestone just recently, right? And they have to go back to everything's paper orders going in and out. You saw it with the supplier in Japan that shut down all of Toyota. These right. are bigger issues. And if you're critical infrastructure and you got to meet these requirements, you are going to pass those requirements down the chain.
So let me take the opposite side to this. This is going to be interesting. So thinking about this, and I draw a parallel from the banking industry, right? I'm going to pick on Wells Fargo. That if we look at Wells Fargo and look at the scandal that they had about cross-selling, I think it becomes a warning to us on making security part of the selling process, that we generate a metric that we're using to therefore differentiate ourselves to the market. But if we're so focused on the metric itself, it may put us as security practitioners in a point where everything is so focused on meeting that metric, on meeting that selling point, that we start to cut corners, that we want to make that look good. Because if we don't make it look good, then we're not going to sell the part. And if we don't sell the part, then we're not viable as a company anymore. So I think we have to be careful attaching security to the sales cycle. I think it puts us in a position that we're going to start meeting metrics for the wrong reason and make bad decisions.
And that's why I think metrics need to stay the heck out of it. I mean, it's an unpopular opinion. If you can't measure it, you aren't doing it. But you can't manage it. But it, I think in the end game, metrics drive the wrong behaviors. I think doing the things that are asked, doing the things that are baseline standards or that you have said you are going to do, take it from metrics and turn it to transparency. This is what we do. This is what we don't do. We take customer requests that say we want to see more of these things in our products. And then you bring them into your development cycle. You start to backlog them, and then you start to slot them to happen. And then they become part of what you put out the other end. It is not, and I'm taking this, this is completely not automotive. This is not manufacturing, because there's a whole, love you all, but there's a whole world out there that never has to do anything manufacturing or quality, that kind of physical quality related.
There's other verticals out there?
Yeah, I know. Shocking. Oh, I serious? Just saw a documentary. That's how I know. but in these other parts, there's this whole set of truly customer driven demand where you get a customer driven, and the cycle is so much smaller, so much shorter that you can bring these things in and you say, look, we need to add multi-factor authentication to something. It's starting to be driven by these industries. Okay. We bring it in, we slot it. We say, here's the demand. Here's the, you know, this is the same in any business industry. We think we have a 10x sales upcycle on this. If we do this now, there's value in putting it in and doing it and doing it well. The metric there is the ROI, the return on the investment to make that piece. So why, you know, I guess that there's, if you have established, if as a security leader, if you have established a good transparency culture and one in which people are open, same. Now this comes back to, you know, being able and willing to pull the cord. Then people will know and do and say, hey, we've got a problem. But at the same time, you've also created a piece where people want to put these features in along with, hey, new whistle and bell that goes into the product itself, because they know there's revenue opportunities, because they know it's actually customer demand. I think short circuiting it because of a potential behavior leads toward more of a cultural question, like how do I establish a culture, rather than not focusing on it as a, as a benefit, because I think it benefits everybody. And you get it out into the market. Now it's competition. Now you have a feature and your competitors don't. They are inclined then to raise their security in order to match, and you now have brought your whole industry, your whole competitive landscape up in security as a result of it.
But the whole
over time,
the whole thing is predicated on assumption that who you're selling to. So it doesn't matter if you're selling to a consumer, to a business within manufacturing. It's all predicated on the maturity of the company on the other side, that there's mm-hmm. a tie between procurement and security. If that isn't there, then we're speaking Greek. I can hand over all of the frameworks in the world. I can walk them through the program and stuff like that. I mean, I'm not trying to take a shot at procurement departments, but procurement departments are used to talking about financials and looking at, okay, what's the risk to the supply chain? Am I not going to be able to get parts onto the shop floor and those things? It's a whole new vernacular for them to start thinking in the terms of security. And by the way, our whole space is changing by the minute. So I can't put on them the expectation for them to stay up on our arena, to have the wherewithal to be able to understand what is the impact, how good is somebody's security program. And let's be honest, I mean, this also goes back to the heart of my fundamental belief that the majority of our security frameworks are broken, that yeah. I could make my program look as good as I want to make it look. And what? So they gave me a piece of paper and said they had all of these controls in place. It must be good. They must have a good security program.
Full disclaimer, the real Eric Willey would never do that.
That is true. That is true. But it's almost like writing an application, right? The UX looks great, but it's spaghetti underneath, right?
So and they take in $100 million in investment because it looks good.
I think it becomes really convoluted too when you go back to the metric side of it, because certain industries, and manufacturing being one of them, is very metrics driven, mm-hmm. right? They can tell you how many parts are going to come off the line every hour, every day, what the return on investment is going to be, because they spent 2 years, you know, before they even kicked it off, trying to define how much they were even going to invest into this assembly line. And Eric, you made a great point too, because the purchasing teams, well, if they're going to be required, and this is going to the direct purchasing side, to go to a supplier to try to understand what they have, right? Based off of a check sheet or a list that's been put together. For them, they're never really going to fathom the difference between supplier A, B, C, or D, right? And right. What I'm saying is from the companies they're purchasing these parts from. And I can look back even 15 years ago when some of these companies said, you know what, we need to get a specialist on hand that just understands just tooling, right? Just an injection mold, just this, because purchasing would look at this and be like, well, I don't know how much this die costs. I don't know how much this costs, right? It was just kind of like, well, let's go back and look at the historical numbers, the metrics. Yep, this all falls in line with what we've been accepting for years,
right?
And then somebody comes in and dives in who's a specialist in it. So until the companies say, not only are we going to invest in security, we're going to invest in people that are really good at it to go to our suppliers to ask questions and to maybe help them along the way, because that's what it's supposed to be. It's not just about saving money, right? It's about helping build your entire supply base up. So I see kind of twofold here, because what ends up happening with these things is the first year of it or 2 years of it is a massive struggle between supplier and customer and trying to understand why you have these rules in place. And then right. As you talk about them more and come together, I think the problem is, though, we've moved so fast for so long in the last 10 years that security for some organizations was just along for the ride and sometimes not even on the same bus, right? Mm-hmm. And now we're all getting together. And I think there's also a little bit of scare, and I can say this coming from automotive suppliers, of being like, I'm afraid for them to even look at this because we don't have a great security posture, right? It shows us how immature we really are.
Right.
Yeah.
I almost wonder, you know, thinking about this, that is the problem getting there with us? You know, as I think through this, that the problem is I'm trying to-
Who's the us?
Security practitioners.
Okay.
That as I think about it, that in my mind, I'm putting this in the context of what would I use to sell my program, but that's probably the wrong way to look at it, right? That we could actually look at the security program. The security program could potentially drive higher SLAs, using their terms, that if, as a company, if we're willing to offer, you know, we're now at 4.9s because we believe in what we're doing from a security program, that's probably where the needle starts to move. Yep. And not trying to sell on the merits of security jargon.
Correct. It's security as a, wait for it, business enabler. Right. You know, things like, you know, you come back to, you mentioned Bridgestone, and I have friends there, and they're dealing with you know, some of the troubles of the last few weeks, and it's not been easy. But what it does is it demonstrates the value of a particular set of security controls that means that downstream supply. And I'm not, you know, not putting anything specific on them because I don't have any of the details of it, just that there was something happening. But we know that supply chain was affected by it. So now it's no longer about, you know, do you have antivirus and do you have a good incident response program? It's now affecting my ability to get your tires to make my cars.
Right.
And now we've taken it out of the propeller head and we've turned it into the petrol head. And it's now something that actually affects the business. This is something we do with, we do when preparing for boards of directors meetings, is they ask that so what on the end of any metric. Okay, we can do, you know, this, and this. We're going to patch 65,000 vulnerabilities and we close down, you know, we stop 2.4 million attacks. Okay, so what? So what in terms of the business? And if you can't answer so what, it's just a metric. It's not any kind of an indicator. Right. And you need to be able to make that last translation of so what, so that the people, and you know, in that case, it's the board of directors, but in other cases, it's customers. It's the people buying your stuff. So what? What does this mean? Can you sell more things? Can you sell less things? You're going to have a greater risk, a 25% risk that this will happen, which means you won't. So what? You won't be able to sell your cars because we can't get you the chip.
Right.
We can't get you the tire.
Go ahead, Brian. I was going to say, like, you ended with something, Eric, where you were talking about SLAs and you said, you know, what if I had 3.9s, Dan? And then you pivoted right over to explaining, you know, from a supply chain, right? So something that's very relevant right now. And I know I always go back to PFEMA, DFEMA, but what if there was an SFEMA, right? Because when you mentioned the nines, Eric, it's not necessarily a metric, right? Because when you look at a security, if we called it security failure mode and effect analysis, and just said, these are the controls I have in place. And this one area is critical, right? But what I've done, I would say, puts me at an 8. And this one puts me at a 9. And this one puts me at an 8. And these next three put me at 9s, right? And my overall score tells me, yeah, these guys have a very good understanding of their security failure mode and effect analysis, right? And you turn that in. And the customers agree to that, because same thing with the PFEMA and DFEMA. It's why you do it. The OE looks at that and says, yeah, I accept that your control plan for your assembly line is effective, right? And although some of these scores, right, look a little risky, it's basically looking at your risk posture mm-hmm. for your assembly. This would be the same thing in saying, you know, can we look at this and say, security wise, like, wait, I'm Mr. Customer doesn't agree with these two areas. And then you discuss them, right? Because that's how that works. You sit down and have a discussion about it and say, well, here's what we've done and here's why we did it. Because every company is going to be different from an assembly line, just like every company is going to be different from a security side.
Right.
But the PFEMA and DFEMA are about closed systems in which you have the ability to inspect, you have the ability to approve and reject all the way along the way. In the security world, you don't. I mean, you just don't have the ability to open up every packet and make a conscious time-based decision whether or not it can come through or not. You also have humans in the mix.
We need bigger computers then, and we could do it. Oh.
Isn't 5G the answer, Dan?
Oh, dear God.
Buzzword. I got a drink.
Straight out of my head.
So, Dan, I moved to the cloud. I do 5G, and I bought shiny objects. Like, no, I'm kidding. But
you're ready for 2022.
I understand what you're saying, though. That at the end of the day, it's not a single production line. Like, you can't look at it as that, because it's right. It encompasses the entire business.
Right.
But I was trying to come up with.
I think you're on the right. I mean, you're paralleling the idea of risk of internal quantified risk assessment, looking at things like FAIR. We've been able to do that kind of quantified risk assessment, including, you know, probability, including impact, for quite some time. And I think the space, the security space, is taking on a lot more of that FAIR mindset. FAIR being a methodology that's been used, I think it originated in the insurance industry around risk, but it is a very, it's one of the more commonly used flips from qualitative risk analysis to quantitative risk analysis, in which you can start to put, dare I say, metrics around your risk. Right. And I think it is a good way to go. And then turning that, but then the inevitable question is, then do I turn that around and say, I have a FAIR rating of this, and therefore you should buy my product?
There's going to be a little bit of, and Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, there's going to be a little bit of that. Like, when we put presentations together, when I was in automotive, like, you talk about our quality scores and quality awards and all these things that you did, because mm-hmm. you're trying to show the new customer, right? Let's just say we were in talking with Ford Motor Company, trying to show them the levels of quality that we had achieved, right? And I'm sure it's the same in other industries, because from what Dan said, mm-hmm. there is things out there besides automotive. So you come in with the presentation and you try to show, like, here's what we've accomplished before. And if security is something that now has become part of not just the business, but part of the requirements, you probably put that information in there. Here's the standards that we've achieved. Here's right. whether you want to call it an award or whatnot, right? And I think having somebody in a leadership standpoint, because we would put that in there too, like from design, like if we were going in to talk transmissions, oh, we also have Mr. So-and-so, right, who's been in the space for 35 years, worked at these three organizations, and accomplished the 12-speed transmission. He's the one leading this program, right? Now you might put in that I have Eric Willie, you know, as a mention of running the security program, right? So I really do think that becomes part of looking 2 years down the road. That does happen now, because it's a requirement.
And right. you're starting to see this happen with the rise of the trust officer in companies, where there is that somebody actually named to be that balance. And, you know, where the security officer, chief information security officer, has often been about the technology, now it's about rising more of that to be customer facing, that true pivot toward how do we build customer trust through these things. And you're seeing, you know, in pharma, the GXP quality becoming part of that. You're seeing security be contributing to that overall trust metric, to that trust framework, and others. And it's I think it is, we live in a time of of concern about trust. And I think it's great to see that that's happening. And I think that alone is an indicator that companies are starting to use this as a business differentiator. And I, you know, and I applaud them for it. I think it's a great, as somebody who's on that, you know, on that software side, spends a lot of time in, you know, in software, there is a whole lot of distrust for people who make software. Who do, and one, and it extends, because it all has to extend back into automotive. It extends into automotive too. What are you doing with those 5G, with those 5G streams of stuff coming out of my car all the time? What are the, you know, why are you selling it to Domino's? No offense, Domino's, local business. you know, what, why are you selling these things to other companies about location data? And why do I not have a way to meaningfully get out of it? I think there's a lot of that trust that's happening. And I think we're going to hit, this is going to hit a, an inflection point soon. So why, I think it's going to only happen more. And I think it's going to include things like transparency of data use in a way that it never has before in the US. It's happening elsewhere, but I think in the US it's going to finally start happening.
Yeah. I think it's inevitable. It's going to have to, I'm going to call it, deem it the squality score. The security quality. So
squality.
Yeah, I'm throwing that out.
Not to be confused with squalor.
No, just thinking about that though. If I mean, going tangential and looking at the supply chain, right? As we go through the era of COVID, really shone a light on, as you thin out the supply chain, the risk to it and disruption on that. And I think the second wave of that is what's going on. Look at the number of companies that have hit the news just in the recent couple of weeks, that security is that next disruptor in the supply chain, and we've got to find a way to get out ahead of it. I mean, as we look at it, and I think we would acknowledge, and this gets back to the thinking about some of our frameworks being broken, right? That we've looked at SOC 1, SOC 2 type reports and just gone, all right, that's good enough. I trust them. We're good, right?
Yeah.
But I think a lot of businesses are taking a step back right now and realizing, okay, well, all right, that's great. You've got an ISO 27001 certification. You've got all of these different things. But really kind of retroflecting, looking at inside the company and acknowledging that that's good, but they are going to get hit at some point. We don't know what the impact is going to be. And I think it's actually, it's going to change some of the fundamentals in how we talk about business continuity, right? That I think traditionally we've looked at business continuity and we've always factored in, all right, being down for a day, a two, maybe a week. But with some of these attacks, I think we need, we're going to have to start looking at a longer time horizon, right? That it could be multiple weeks, it could be months, and that could wreak havoc on the supply chain. So I'm right there with you guys. I think the procurement, security, supply chain, all of that's got to start to come together to start looking at those aspects. I think there is an opportunity that it becomes on the near term that security is a differentiator.
Look at Saudi Aramco. They were not back on a network for 5 months.
Yeah.
And look what happened. They had to purchase 50,000 computers. They had people traveling over to Asia saying, can we get to the front of the line? Yes, we can, but you're going to pay 10X. Okay. We need to buy everything we can hardware wise. And it caused the price of laptops, desktops, and servers to jump and stay super high for 6 months following that, just so they could get everything back online. So if you look at it from a historical standpoint, and they had the power though to give away free oil, meaning as they were trying to figure out how to going back to paper, right? Same thing that Bridgestone's doing right now, went back to paper, understanding everything that's going in and out to keep production going. They had trucks lined up for days trying to get to the oil. And finally the government said, we're just going to have to start giving it away for free because we can't keep track of it. And we're creating a global condition right now that is not good. I don't think other automotive suppliers have the ability to say, I'm going to give away my parts for free right now just because I can't keep track of it. And I want to keep, you know, Mr. Toyota going and Mr. GM going. That's what Mr. GM and Mr. Toyota are thinking, right? But that's where it makes it really, really, really hard. And I think the threat actors have looked at that and they realize that if you can go to the supply chain, right? And this is where it is part of the business, right? And, you know, going back to the banking systems, Dan, when you mentioned some of the banking controls and everything, why JP Morgan Chase tried to develop or did develop its own cloud. Originally though, and I'm getting some of this from the book, The Dawn of the Cold War, when you go back and look at when the banks were first started to get attacked, and the government kind of stepped in to tell them this is what's going on. But I think the banks a little bit thought maybe the government can step in and help us. And the government had to draw a line in the sand and say that it's not our job. Oh yeah, there we go. Dawn of the Code War. For everybody listening and watching, Eric just put the book up. And the government had to draw a line in the sand and basically say whether or not they were there to help police, right? We can tell you, but we're not going to police. We can't go stop this from happening. And the reason for that was the government could see in the 5 years prior what was happening, and they didn't have the bandwidth to handle that. And they knew the length of time it actually took to prosecute somebody to gather all the evidence that was needed, right? And they had lawyers in the room that were kind of helping them along the way with what we can and cannot be responsible for. And so the banks had to make a decision. Well, if the government's not going to police this for us, then we really have to start doing something, right? But it was the banking industry that really was one of the first to really be attacked, right? Where DDoS attacks were rolling in to try to shut down systems, because they realized if you could just overwhelm them in the middle of the day, we could take the financials offline. That hurts the U.S. people. And now what they're finding is what hurts the U.S. people or any country is if you can really go after a supply chain attack and hurt their biggest, enterprises and these companies that really are pivotal to the economy, then we can cripple these guys overnight. It sends shockwaves through the system.
I'm a firm believer, and this is one of the conversations I had with some of our key suppliers last year. I'm still a firm believer that at some point that we're going to start seeing suppliers down the chain get hit, and then attackers are going to come back up the chain and ask some of the OEMs or tier ones to start paying to release them. I think it's just amount of time.
Thank you for giving the idea. They do appreciate your innovation on their behalf.
We've all got to make predictions, right?
I don't disagree at all.
Yeah, it's like every year we keep talking about, oh, this year it's going to be the year of the OT attacks. Okay, it still hasn't happened. But next year is going to be the year of the OT attacks.
But Eric, you're right, because it comes down to who's their customer, right? Like if you hack Colonial Pipeline, Colonial Pipeline says, even though we are back online, we're not going to ship oil because we can't keep track of what's going in and out, and the American people can pay more for it.
Right.
But if you attack this supplier and it shuts down GM or shuts down Toyota, no. Like they need to keep going. That supplier only has five customers, right? And those five customers aren't going to stay down.
I mean, if you think about it, yes, could I be planning an idea? Sure, but probably not. I mean, let's look at the Conti leaks, right? Let's look at that. I mean, they're pulling D&B reports on companies. Their research that they're doing on the organizations they're going after, they've already played these scenarios out. We're just catching up to them. This is what they live and breathe. They do every day. And let's be honest, that's not what we're doing every day. Because we've got reporting, we've got people leading, we've got all of these different aspects. I mean, I always love the image. Like somebody created a meme one time, and I forget the company who did it, but it's a sheet of paper, what the attacker has to do and what we have to do. Yeah. And they have to attack, and we've got all of these different components, not to say we shouldn't be doing those things, but there's a lot more to what we do as security practitioners than just defending and thinking up what comes next.
It's so true. And yeah, since you mentioned that about the people going upstream, and I'm going to switch a little bit, and I'm going to take the negative side on this debate. I'm going to go on the against side for just a second, because I think one of the big criticisms.
We need a little sound clip when we make that change.
Wah, wah. Oh no, that's sad trombone. The idea that this industry, the security world, has long been built on collaboration, on cross collaboration. You know, I worked in industries where there was fierce competition at a business level, but behind the scenes, we as security practitioners were always in touch with each other. We were always staying on top of what was happening in our field, and we were sharing valuable, non-competitive insights with each other because it was the right thing to do. And I think there is this fear that when security becomes a competitive advantage more and more, that collaboration will go away and that we have, what's that?
Yeah, I'm going to hold my cards close to my chest.
Yeah, exactly. Because now it's about revenue. And I mean, I think there's something to that, but I also think that there is You know, there's a difference between threat and attack information and building good features into the things you do and building good process. And everybody wins with good process. And we also, I also think you need to go in realizing that any advantage you have is time limited. You're not right. going to be the leader in security forever in your field because others will catch up. They'll have to catch up. You're forcing them to catch up. So, I think this level of collaboration is critical. I mean, I was part of it in my earliest days, working in and talking with some of the best security teams around the world and sharing information with them and getting it back. And I wouldn't be where I am today without that kind of collaboration. So I do get it. But at the same time, a company's commitment to implementing components and security shouldn't necessarily be I didn't stay on the negative very long, did I? I just went right back.
I was actually going to counter and beat Brian to an automotive reference, but you think about it, that you can still share at a macro level. I don't think that changes. Look at manufacturing, right? Look at what we do. We, you know, take an axle. Anybody can buy a car, take it apart and see the end result of a manufacturing process. But what we're not going to talk to you about is the actual engineering that goes through. That's kind of our secret sauce on how we do things. And I think we've all got that as security practitioners that we probably don't share to the greatest depth. You know, maybe a couple of us one-on-one, just kind of aside from some of the bigger events. I don't really think that goes away per se, because I think the majority of what we do is still at a fairly macro level. What are you doing in this space? You know, are you starting to look at XDR? Are you starting to look at these components? And that's not getting down into the actual process that makes the tools effective.
And if you'd like more information on that, see the episode that I'll link, in which we talk about the fact that tools alone do not solve a problem, but in fact are mandatory to have good people and process underneath it, or you'll just have yourself a shiny piece of software that spins and you don't know what it does.
Unless we deem ourselves as the tools, and then, oh.
I real quick, I was just trying to go back and look up Kojima Industries, because I thought that would be a nice use case example of understanding the complexity of some organizations, right? Just like the company I worked for before.
Kojima being the games developer.
Well, Kojima being the company that was hit that shut down Toyota.
Ah, see, okay.
Most people don't draw the correlation that, like, all these companies, like, you, if you look them up, you say, well, how many employees does this company have? So when you look them up, you're like, oh, it says they only have 30 employees. That's 30 employees at the one location. When you really figure out how many affiliates Kojima falls under, right? Kojima Industries, not just Kojima Productions, you realize that this company is massive, right? And it's linked to this company and that company. And it's difficult to go through all the information, but at the end of the day, it shut down over 17 Toyota manufacturing facilities, Daihatsu facilities, Hino facilities. That's a lot of production that ends up getting shut down. But the only thing that everyone read about online was Toyota suffered a cyber attack. Well, that wasn't totally true. Toyota's suffering from a cyber attack. You have to read the news correctly. Toyota themselves wasn't attacked. They are suffering because a supplier got hit in a cyber attack, which shut down their production. And it wasn't just Toyota. Aishin, all these other suppliers also got hit and shut down because of Kojima, because the plastics that they make, and this goes back to having a karetsu, right? A supply base that you're all interconnected and intertwined. It affected everybody. So, and the fact is, this is very public news. And if you're a threat actor reading that, you're like, wow, you know, if we do our research, we can really find at the heart a supplier on the tier two level, right? That takes care of everybody.
Maximum impact,
right? So, I mean, this goes back to the game of chess and the game of, if you want to call it the game of war, and saying, like, what move do I make? What has the biggest impact to slow down this impending army? Right. And if it's blowing up my own bridge, maybe I do that to slow it down. And someone would say, well, why would you do that?
That's really interesting. I hadn't actually considered that as we change the way we look at the supply chain and some of our key suppliers, looking at it through the lens of the impact to us. But if you start to look at it, what's the global impact? What other customers do they sell to? Could actually raise the risk level of a given supplier because they could be seen to hit multiple companies at the same time. That's interesting. That's another.
So Eric, and this kind of goes back to the OE shouldn't be creating standards for security, because if that little company had to follow seven different security programs because each OE comes up with their own level, right? That this is where you have to be. That's where it becomes really, really hard, because these companies aren't making, they're not software companies that are, you know, making more, I don't want to say a number, but if you go to manufacturing, these guys are making 5% or less profit a year, right? And you can see that because they're public facing entities. At the end of the day, if they had to prescribe to seven different security protocols because seven different customers have seven different requirements. And that's where the idea of, Dan, when I put out the SFEMA, right? A PFEMA, DFEMA, or if we have a squality, right? Your squality forms, Eric. If the suppliers, if the OEs can come together from like an auto ISAC standpoint, but that's more in tune to the automotive vehicle, but understanding how that affects your supply chain is also very important, because this still is about business, right? And having a seat at the table for that, right? And Eric, you said rising tides rise all ships. Well, hopefully, but if the cost to rise with that tide is heavy for some of these other companies, that's where the support, and I'm just kind of rambling along now.
No, I completely agree. And I think the crux of the issue is since we're picking on automotive, since we're sitting in Detroit, I think one of the biggest problems we have right now is security in automotive manufacturing does not have a compliance framework. We need something. We need something. As much as it pains me to say, we need to be singing from the same hymnal, but I think we can look at the financial sector to figure that out. Because right, as you start getting into taking apart banking, there's different thresholds based on the amount of money that you have, so that the mom and pop bank that's servicing a small town can still survive, but still have some controls to make them solvent and protect those that are investing in that bank, up to the JP Morgans that are global and across. I think we can accomplish the same thing. And I think we need to accomplish the same thing. I think it's good that the OEs, the tier ones, that we're all thinking about this, that, hey, we need security in the supply chain. But the problem is the amount of effort that is going in right now for all of us to write our own different frameworks, our questionnaires and all of that. We are draining resources. So back to that list of what attacker has to do and what the security team has to do. I'm spending so much time filling out surveys from different companies. Let's get together. Let's change this. Everybody's on board that we need to do security, create a unified framework.
But that requires people to stop believing that they are special. And that is the hardest thing to do. My industry is different. You wouldn't understand. I have different risks. Now,
but I wake up every morning and tell myself I'm special.
Stuart Smalley does too. But the idea that we have to start getting over ourselves. Now back to this is actually a direct play to competitive advantages. I'm different because I'm better at this. How do we get past that enough to be able to say, but I'm still the same as everyone else in my industry or everyone else doing this kind of thing, and get to a single set of quantifiable risk. Now the higher ed industry has taken a really neat thing. EDUCAUSE is a consortium of people, of security professionals and technology and a lot of other topics within the higher ed space, and has created what's called the HECVAT. It's the higher ed, I'm gonna get letters for not remembering what it stands for, but I'll put a link to it. HECVAT is a risk vehicle. You answer a prescribed set of questions. The community comes together, sets the questions. Then you, from the answers, you answer it once as a supplier. You put it up, and then if somebody wants to buy, they can download it. It's publicly visible, and then they can look through the answers and come up with their own set of what's important to us. They can use those and quantify how they want to. It's actually a really, really neat way to do it. And I'd love to see more industries do this. There's another company, I think, called Coral, C-O-R-L, that has started to try and do this risk intermediation, disintermediation between the company and the, It's a reusable risk assessment, same kind of thing, but it's a supplier that they do it for you, and then they can help work with you to get the specific specific risks you're interested in. By the way, neither of these are suppliers. I happen to be part of EDUCAUSE and part, you know, for work, and I kind of do, you know, I do some of the work in there, but but these are, you know, these are interesting ways to go about it. But the uptake outside of higher ed, I haven't seen uptake like this across any other industry, because, you know, in higher ed you're competitive, but not on, this is not a place where there's competition. You know, you don't decide where to go to school based on who has the greatest security program.
Right. I mean, I, on that idea, I mean, I love where that's heading. To plug a partner that we're using now, Cyteris. So Dave Glenn, formerly from CBI, that I think the majority of people, or if not everybody in the Detroit community knows, he moved over to there. And one of the things that we're doing with them is the C2MA. So their cybersecurity capacity maturity assessment. And what they've done is taken the realization that the majority of frameworks, there's so much overlap that we could answer kind of baseline assessment across the breadth of security. And then once you have that, it doesn't matter what your framework is, that you could tie it in and we can map all of our controls back and produce a report. And, you know, do you want NIST? Do you want ISO 27001? Do you want TISAX? Sure, that's fine, because we've already got the unified control framework. And I'm right there with you, Dan. I think that's the right approach, that if we could create kind of some type of governing body or somewhere where those controls, then different organizations that want to see it mapped a different way can just plug into it and pull down the controls that are relevant to what they care about.
But now flip back, the other side is, now I spend time. So these are starting to happen in some places, poorly in many, where you've got these BitSight and security scorecard and other people doing this. And I have to spend more time managing those to say, you know, first of all, nobody signs up to the same one. There's now huge competition amongst those.
Right.
And more popping up all the time. And then I have to spend time managing each of those. And then I get a note out of the blue from somebody else saying, fill out our questionnaire in this third thing. And then I have to go do it again. So it's just perpetuating the problem from spreadsheet to now paid software with ads and people trying to sell me more things.
Right.
And, you know, it'd be a pity if you didn't have your own information in there and people would look badly upon you.
spending time addressing disinformation.
Well, exactly, because otherwise you look bad. And I think that, you know, anytime there's something to be done, there's going to be competition. Back to competitive advantage, there's going to be competitors trying to make it better and better and better. And we live in a commercial world. We live in a capitalistic world. And so people are going to spin up a business. And now you might set a consortium, but 4 weeks later, another one's going to come up and it's going to be commercial. I'm like, we're better than that. And so now you've got this competitive advantage actually causing trouble and causing us to now have to fill out 9 of these things, because I gotta manage this silly vendor and this silly vendor and this silly risk vendor that doesn't understand my business, and this other one, and then more and more and more. And now I'm back to filling out the spreadsheets, but doing it on a web, on 9, 10, 15 web pages instead of that one place we had all agreed to.
Right. Well, I look at it, I think the opportunity that if you ask the question, where are we already connecting and where are we playing? And I think the ISACs really have an opportunity to do some of that. If I look at the list of companies that are part of the automotive ISAC, I think that has the biggest propensity to be able to drive that unification.
Yeah. And we, in my days in the financial services ISAC, it was definitely, you know, FS ISAC is very much a leader in the ISAC space and has been a trailblazer from the beginning. And I was lucky enough to be part of it in the earliest days, and watching that be successful is great. I don't think every industry is quite so lucky. And again, there's commercial interests. They're buying services from third parties to run. Many are buying third parties, buying operation services for those ISACs. I think you're right, though. They are the best hope, but not everybody is in critical infrastructure either.
Yeah, right. It's funny, because I agree on the automotive ISACs, that could be a staging point for a lot of these conversations. I applied for the automotive ISACs, but I think because I work for a vendor, I never got it fully accepted. But Eric, something you said, and this is where I think it reigns so true. If you have somebody in a security program and you pull them out, and somebody driving the race car and you pull them out and put them in the pit crew, because he's had so many years of experience driving the car and understanding the brake feel and the wear and tear of the tires and everything else, I spent 16 and a half years working in auto and understand like from the purchasing relationships and how that stuff gets driven down. Right. And I can tell you that the company I work for did business with almost every OEM, but there was one or two that we did not, specifically because the requirements around quality, we didn't deem them appropriate, and that the investments to do that weren't worth the price of our component, right? We weren't going to bring the price up to try to compete or keep it at this lower level with the cost that it was going to take to meet that requirement. So we just say no, right? Now companies and from the security side, I can already tell you that there are suppliers right now that have gone back to certain OEs to tell them that their price of good has gone up because of their security requirements. And it's not because they're, how do I say this, upset with, you know, you're forcing me to do this. They didn't have a security posture before, but they were given an ultimatum in a short period of time that they had to make certain investments to show something, almost to check the box. And the business goes back and looks at those things to say, oh my God, we just made X amount of investment. And it's the plants that end up screaming because the plants didn't have those budgets set for the year. So they go back and tell the business, well, our costs went up. You need to go get this money from the customer. And it becomes an argument, right? And Eric, you probably know this. The plants do carry a lot of power because they produce the finished goods. And if a plant comes back and says, this was unbudgeted, I didn't have it in there, you need to go recover it, is what they say. So what happens when you tell a sales team to go recover it? They go back to Mr. Customer and say, hey, we need to recover X amount per part because of this investment. Our plant was forced to do this because of your requirement, right? And then OE comes back and says, well, you guys didn't have this security posture, didn't have this. We understand, but that wasn't a requirement when we got the business. And we've had this business for 2 years, and now you're telling us we have to do this. And that's what you're starting to see, right? And this is where, if in the automotive ISACs, if you brought the groups together, because I think you're going to see this, not just in automotive, but other industries. If you go back and look at the list of verticals that are going to be considered critical industry, right? Critical infrastructure, that's going to have a ripening effect down the supply chain, right? And those people down there, the lower levels, are going to come back and say, there's a cost associated. Of course, there's a cost associated with it. But then how do you recover? Because that's what business wants to understand. And that's where coming up with, I don't want to use the word unified, but at least an agreement across, you know, from an automotive ISACs, what is the low bar and the high bar, right? That we should be asking, right? Or what is the quality, right? Requirement, security quality, right? Like
we'll have marketing work on that name.
Yeah. Come up with something, right? That everybody can gravitate towards, because if one company says, well, look what we did. We set the bar so high that our security quality is going to be the best. Right. But you set it so high that the cost of entry, right, for a company that maybe doesn't need XYZ, right? Because it comes down to people, process, and product. That it shouldn't just be about going out and buying product. This could be an argument for these companies to actually get the funding they need to put a few people in place that can come up with the framework to meet those requirements, right? Like, and it's going to be a process. It's not just going to happen overnight. And if you force it overnight, companies are just going to go out and spend a bunch of money on a bunch of shiny tools, checkmark a bunch of things, and then come back and try to ask for a price increase.
So last topic, we're getting to the end of the time, but I want to take what you just said, Brian, and go into the last round here around, should security be an upcharge in a product? You know, brakes are not an upcharge. Better brakes are, but should things like, you know, you develop a single sign-on technology, you sing multiple multi-factor authentication. You said just now, there's cost to those things. The costs have to be recouped somehow. Should there be tiers of price that means it costs money to get actual security in the things you buy, in the things you do, in the things in the technologies you bring into your environment?
If you're talking about software companies, I mean, for what they're already recovering, the security should already be there. But when you're talking into your everyday products, right? Like the sugar cone, right? That you're putting your ice cream in, the brakes that you're buying for your car. I think there is going to be a little bit of, cost associated with that, where companies that haven't had that security posture, right? Or haven't put in, you know, it's like trying to fireproof their building. Like, they realize they haven't been meeting these new codes that come out. You have to put those capital investments in.
But do you charge it to everyone? Do you spread it like peanut butter, or and build it in across everything, or do you find ways that you get you then charge more for the let's go to the ice cream cone example. You have the base ice cream cone with the, you know, questionably GMO products, and then you have the ones with more pure, you know, understood, yeah, and you know, better light, better you understand what's in it more. Do you do charge more for those?
Does that translate to security? In my previous life, the answer to that would be yes. We would charge more. Now, most people are thinking, oh my gosh, you would charge more, but we're talking pennies per part, right? And but
pennies
those,
add up.
Those pennies definitely add up. But I look at that type of charging per part very different than software companies that maybe haven't built in security to their processes, right? Or to their software. Eric, thoughts?
Lots of thoughts. To phrase the question a different way, I mean, if you're talking about putting the question or the decision in the hands of the customer that, hey, what security level do you want? I would not be for that, because I think in the court of public opinion, that does not play well for the company that's selling that service, that the headline is now you're putting your reputation on the line based on a decision, a cost decision for the end customer. And at the end of the day, you are going to be the headline as the company. And when you try to spend it, yeah, but our customer chose that they only wanted the basic security package. That's not going to matter. And I think it actually, from a cost perspective, I would imagine it would start to erode economies of scale, because now you've got different bands. I've got to manage different customers differently. I think it becomes overly complex to try to manage. I'd rather see it just.
You'd only have one level, right?
Yeah. But and it's then, so
then you'd be going back trying to tell all your customers, well, this is the level we adhere to. And those you might have a customer say, well, we don't need that. Like, right? Like,
yeah,
that's where the customer.
Well, I don't want your bands. I want to a la carte it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and just this week, and I'll close with this. The race to the bottom on dollars is always the fundamental when it comes to the people buying, you know, the procurement. We talked earlier about the procurement team, and I have probably another 20 minutes I could go on about, you know, procurement race to the bottom, only buying the lowest cost. Here in Ann Arbor, there was just this week, the city council decided not to go with the lowest cost bidder because they both didn't declare their violations in their bid, and they had violations in their bid. The company had violations, you know, previously, and so they took one that was a little less of a safety risk, but cost more. So that's one. So in that case, something worked well in finding that balance. But you just look this week, Disney Plus announced, and I'm not a subscriber, but people pay for it, and now they've announced there's a lower cost tier coming with ads. So people, and the expectation is that people are going to flock to this because
HBO did that too.
It's about dollars. It's not about the value of your time. It's not about your safety, because people will make the dollars decision and not take the pure dollars decision first and not take the other things into account. Now, I'm not saying this isn't about security, but this is about time. It's about ads. It's about, you know, the value of your time and how much quantity you can consume in a particular amount of time. I'm a big fan of no ads, but your mileage may vary, and I guess they're giving you choice. In the security world, I don't quite see that. I'm with you, Eric, and that over time, you're actually introducing more complexity in your environment by creating multiple security bands, multiple capability bands. It's more costly to keep them, and you run the risk, and complexity is the enemy of good security.
Right, yeah, it almost gets to security as a subscription model, and I'm not there.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll always go back to my favorite SSO, single sign-on as a tax, SSO.tax, great website listing. I don't know if they're keeping it up to date still, but listing of companies that charge extra for single sign-on, whereas single sign-on is one of those things that should be part of everything. Even the smallest companies should have the ability to get it to a single sign-on solution, because boy, it's good. And it's actually better for the company that whose service you're buying, because it means they're not getting storing passwords and having to deal with that mishigas. Anyhow, we are out of time. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Brian. Great debate. We actually did some very good pivots around the topic today, and I learned a ton. And thank you to you, the listener. We really appreciate you being here and taking the time. Please do take some time, though, and let us know what you think. Send us an email. feedback at greatsecuritydebate.net. We want to hear what you think of the episode. We want to hear what you think of the topics we're doing, and we want your ideas for future topics. We have a LinkedIn page where we post the show notes and announce new episodes coming out. They try and come out every other week. We have a Twitter at Security Debate. Follow there. And we have a YouTube channel. Just search for Great Security Debate if you want to see these versions in video, in live, in living color, and not on NBC. You can go find us on YouTube. Please tell friends if you think that they'd enjoy hearing the episode, and we will be back soon for another Great Security Debate.